Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Kevin Tuas Allen is a successful British singer, songwriter, producer, DJ, businessman, entrepreneur, and author. He started his award-winning career at the age of 15 in the music industry, working for 80s supergroup Five Star at their Sunningdale mansion as their in-house photographer. At the age of 19, Kevin created the iconic Winston the Churchill Bulldog before shooting to fame as a record producer or DJ, selling over 20 million records, 13 number ones, and BBC Radio Producer of the Decade from 1990 to 2000, producing music for Beyoncé, Britney Spears, Justin Timberlake, Ne-Yo, The Pussycat Dolls, Tweet, Akon, Lionel Richie, Phil Collins, and Usher, with over 170 plus productions across all the main music labels. Kevin's DJ career has seen him perform at Ministry of Sound London, Space, Amnesia in Ibiza, Beverly Hills Celebrity Parties, Heaven Nightclub in London and LA, and the exclusive Kensington Roof Gardens. In 2008, Kevin swapped his musical and live entertainment career for the corporate world. Kevin ran many notable and profitable AIM Series A startups. Kevin also ran a leading creative agency called Wonderful, and was also the first strategist and entertainment director at Unilad. Clients included Group M, Omnicom, Mediacom, Freud's, Evian, and more. Kevin was the most senior VP of Unidays of London and New York City, helping global brands reposition their sales and marketing to Gen Z audiences through more relevant and relatable content and campaigns. Clients included Samsung, NFL, MTV, Live Nation, and more. In 2018, Kevin joined Street Soccer Foundation as CMO, now the number one sports homeless charity in the UK, and has changed over 10,000 young people's lives. Kevin has been nominated as a top 10 chief marketing officer in 2022 in the USA by Industry Era magazine. He has also been selected as a top 10 businessman in 2022 in the UK for MSP News Global. Kevin has conceived and is in the process of writing the six-part fantasy book series, Ghosts of the Monarchy. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Kevin Tuas Allen. Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
I'm actually in London, England, and I'm fine. I'm very, very busy at this time, and it's a pleasure to be in your brilliant podcast, which I've heard so much about.
Oh, thank you. Where do you hear about it? I'm interested to hear.
Via LinkedIn. It was quite a few business community leaders that were speaking of your name, and a good friend of mine, Richard, said, you got to this guy's show business. This is a bit of you, and here you are.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, sometimes when I'm sitting in a silo doing everything by myself, you don't know if it's reaching people because you know you get a little bit of feedback here and there, but you help me. Yeah, that's great feedback. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay, so now let's rewind. At what age did you feel cool? You want to be in this space, and how did that journey progress to where we are today?
Yeah, it's mad, actually. I knew from about 13, I always wanted to be in the music industry, but it didn't propose itself until much later in life. And I had to wait till I was 19 to really get into it. But the kind of interim period was, we had a pop magazine in England called Smash It.
Oh, huge. Yes. Sorry to interrupt before you, Karen. I've still got all my Smash Hits from back in the day. It's on my cupboard. I love Smash It. Yes, carry on.
Yeah, it was a big deal, right? It was the magazine of the time. Yeah. Like nothing touched it. Yeah. And my favorite pop group at the time was Five Star, who were the most successful black five-piece British group of all time. One best group in 1987, 17 hits, crazy numbers. And I was told at work experience that I should be stacking biscuits. And I was like, no, to my careers advisor. I said, I'm going to go to Ascot Sunningdale, knock on the doorbell of one of the most successful pop groups in the world and ask them for work experience. And I was like, of course you are. So I asked my mum, and she said, of course you are. Of course, that's a completely dumb thing. For 15 years, under 15 years old, I took myself on a train to Sunningdale alone and worked out on the map where they live because of the Smash Hits. They did a feature on them, found the house, knocked on the doorbell, and the oldest member of the group was there, and he goes, you can't stack biscuits. Come and be our photographer. Because we had an interest in photography. It was my ace grade up. That was my thing. And so we, and the next day, my dad and my mom went to Sunningdale, this beautiful £2 million mansion, which the Queen Mother used to live in, exceptional building. And I started work on Monday. And that was my love of music personified into a professional career. They started it off. So that was the dream, and it was the best gig in the world.
So how long were you a photographer with them for?
2 weeks officially, okay. But I stayed in touch for months and months and months. They eventually moved into Los Angeles the year afterwards, so we kind of cut ties there. But the bug for music, production, drums, strings, vocal harmonies, it was embedded. It was there for life, and they taught me so much. They were such a kind family, and they were my foundations.
Okay, so now what were the next steps?
So I kept progressing into music as a DJ and getting into leisure companies and being in music. And then I met a couple of chaps. One was called Pete Tong. He was an up-and-coming DJ. And the other one was Judge Jules.
Yes, I've interviewed Judge Jules. Yes, carry on.
So actually Jules was the first person to sign me in 1995.
Oh, wow.
And then by 1996, I was top 10 in the charts. And then that whole dream from being 13 when I knew what I wanted, 15 work experience to 19, I was a household name. And I was literally on That's What I Call Music, whatever it was. 16, 25, 30, can't remember. But I then spent, 170 odd productions, 13 number one records, BBC producer of the decade. And it was 16 years of heaven. Hard work, very hard work. People think, oh, you're so lucky to work. I was like, lucky? Lucky had nothing to do with it. It was pure. I mean, I didn't watch a movie for probably 16 years. So people say to me, oh, have you seen Home Alone? I was like, nah.
No.
I was recording. And it's the crazy thing about my life.
So wait, were you producing for other artists?
Yeah.
For the listening audience, what does it mean to be a producer for another artist?
There's two sides to it. So either the record company will have a record they've signed and they want, basically, my job was, can you make it for radio? Can you make it on BBC, Kiss FM, Capital, Heart? And or can you make it the biggest club record that you've ever seen in Ibiza, in New York and LA? So that's one side of it. Or you get a demo and you have to work out with the artist and you have to create all the parts. So it's basically the drums and the music all fell on my shoulders. So, but I had to interpret it as like a radio record. So it had to be commercial. It had to sell millions of units and it had to win awards. Those are kind of the parameters.
Okay. So when you got a brief from a record label, it was like millions, awards. Did you find that intimidating and think, oh, okay, now what happens if it doesn't achieve that?
Oh, God, yeah. It was so much pressure. It was so much pressure. And normally you'd have a 3-day turnaround. Like, for instance, my first top 10 record was like, you've got until Friday, and it was on the Monday. I mean, that was a 5-day on that. But like, I was like, it closes on Friday. And if you've not produced the big hit, it's not yours to have. And I was like, oh, my God. And we actually did 3 different versions of the track. And it was only on Friday, 5 o'clock. Pete Tong was in Universal Music and he heard the version that I'd created. And he said, what's this? It was like, this is amazing. And he's like, I'm going on air in 1 hour. It's like the Essential Mix, Pete Tong, right? Radio 1, Friday night. The whole world listened to Radio 1 at 6 p.m. on a Friday. And he had the acetate cut in that hour. And it was his first video. This is the anthem of the year. Boom. And that was it. And within 7 weeks, it was top 10, 500,000 copies sold.
And which song was that?
It was called Josh Wink, Higher State of Consciousness. It was an absolute dance anthem.
I remember that. So you said you were in production for 16 years. What were some of the challenges that you felt during that period that you learned life lessons from and that you overcame to become successful?
Resilience was the big one. You get a lot of knockbacks. You know, even though if a consumer hears a finished record, you can have 20, 30 amends to that. And I found that later in life in advertising, when you make videos or adverts or websites or brands, that you get a lot of kickback from the CEO or the creative team. I don't like that color. I don't like that font. And the music, it's the same. The bass drum's not loud enough. I need a more techno bass drum. The strings aren't, I want more orchestral strings. So resilience, it is super tough because it could be very hard to hear sometimes when you spend hours and hours and hours on this one thing. And they go, that's crap, don't like it. And you go, oh my gosh, I'm like, okay. And then you have to innovate. The other thing about resilience is you then have to kind of park that in your brain mentally, which is super tough to do, particularly at 20 years of age, and then suck it up and then start again, a new storyboard, a new vision, a new pathway, until somewhere up the top of that record company, they go, that's fantastic, that's the one. And there's no rhyme or reason, there's no rule book, they haven't got one either. They just go, yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah.
And actually never give you any feedback. It would just be, don't like it.
And it's just their perceptions, because they might be like,
it's just theirs.
It might be 5 million other people that do love it. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that was always the fight with Pete Tong and Judge Jules, is Jules hated my mix. Hated. Pete's like, it's an absolute anthem. Sod off. It's essential new tune tonight. I know what I'm doing. And Jules is like, but it's crap. And he goes, it's amazing. It's so and like a year later, Jules is like, I'm so sorry. I gave you so much heat for that. And you were right. I was wrong. But we've been lifelong friends since. And he's such a lovely guy. But they both are. But Jules particularly is a honey. I just adore him.
Yeah,
he's so easy to work with. He's so clever. And he's a lawyer. You'd never know. But my God, he's so clever.
Exactly. Now, these list some of the other songs that you produce, like 5 or 6 of those other songs that you produce that the listeners would know of that were top 10s or hits and so forth.
Yeah, sure. So let's start with Britney Spears and Toxic.
Oh,
Beyonce,
okay.
Beyonce Crazy in Love.
Yes.
Pussycat Dolls, Don't Ya.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Usher, Loving This Club. Lionel Richie, All Night Long remixes.
Wait, so now, were you at the same record label for the entire period of time where you had this repertoire and catalog, or did you move around?
I was freelance. So how it works as a music producer is, we had artist management. They looked after Boy George and Robert Miles. They were great at artist management. They would intercept briefs from Universal, Warner, EMI, or Sony Music. And Sony Music, RCA was one of their 20 labels, had 70 artists alone. So they'd often have a brief. So here's the new Pink record. Want a different version of this made. Got 3 days, off you go. And then they'd negotiate fees. You'd get the demo part sent to you by courier. You'd make it and send it back by courier normally, or you'd go into the record company and play the record. So it was freelance 360 the whole time, which is much better as well, because you get better repertoire. You don't get too bogged in politics. Mm. You can flip and feel wherever you need to.
Was it more so remixes, brief on remixes, than the actual original songs that you were working on?
A bit of both, actually.
Oh, both. Okay.
There was a lot of dance productions, but it was instrumental in making some of the big hits of the years gone by. Yeah.
Oh, lovely. I know that originally Kathy Dennis wrote Toxic for Kylie. And
she did.
And then
that's right. That's it.
I know my music.
And Kathy's a wonderful songwriter. I mean, she's written like 100 hits, and she's so humble about it all. But that record started out quite different as well. It was a lot more pop than what she kind of got it, because those original strings weren't like it was never that. It was very placid, and we certainly took it to a different place. But she was an amazing songwriter, and still is.
I've got all her CDs from when she was actually singing music.
As in All Night Long, and
I've got all of it. Okay, so I brought this into the conversation, so I'm bringing it in now. I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs every month. I love the aesthetic of the choice, the journey, the experience of receiving, unpacking, listening to song from one to whatever number. I'm sure being in the industry, I'm unsure if you do know, vinyl's on a massive comeback. Last year, 5.9 million sales, the biggest since 1990. Cassettes are on a comeback, and CDs. In fact, I was reading an article earlier on in the year that you guys in the UK have a basket of products that are represented that they gauge for tax purposes. And vinyls have been in it for a longest period, but now because of the upsurge of sales in CDs, they are now back in the basket. But now we've also got these streaming platforms that people can consume music on. What are your observations and perceptions of the landscape at the moment?
Yeah, I think it's never going to go back to a place of physicality in the way that we know it. And there's a reason for that. Is when I was at the top of my game in England, we had over 750 nightclubs. Okay, so vinyl was the thing. You took vinyl to work. Everybody bought vinyl at home. House parties were all vinyl. Now it's just very different. There's like under 50 clubs now in the United Kingdom. It's completely destroyed. It's gone. But people, I say this in a nice way, people's dance floors have changed. They've just moved here in the most part. But then what's happened because of the demise of nightclubs, the festival market in the world, Tomorrowland, Austin, Glastonbury, has amazingly exploded, because people still need nightclub, or what they really want is a place to experience live music with friends and an audience in a safe environment. And I love that. So I'm sad that it's gone, it's moved on. I think it's a great nostalgia to bring back cassettes and CDs. It's amazing. And I'm with you. I love the experience. I like the touch and feel. I have thousands of them all catalogued.
Yes.
But I also love the journey. One of the things originally taught was through Janet Jackson's team at Rhythm Nation is that kind of intro that you have for Rhythm Nation in the first track and then another interlude. And you have this album journey. And so my role was actually an exec producer. So I often got put in charge of albums where did all of the tracks actually have a narrative? Was it a theme? Was it a dangerous style for Michael Jackson? Was it Rhythm Nation level? You know, what was the narrative? Is it about racism? Or, you know, and there was always the albums that did the best had a narrative from start to finish, not just the hits. The whole conjecture was amazing. And I use Rhythm Nation because she was really the first person. I know Michael did loads of stuff, but she took racism to a new level and bigotry and challenged innocence and gun crime like no other black artist did in the world. And I have so much respect for Janet because every video in that seven singles, every hit that she had, every tour that she made, every process that she helped Congress change laws was down to her and her writing with Terry Jam and Lewis. Just phenomenal.
You were in the production for 16 years and then you moved on from that. Why did you move on and what were the next steps?
So in 2008, we were due a world recession, as everybody knows, and it was pretty bad in England. It was hideous. And I didn't want to be a crusty old man with a pair of headphones on in a nightclub with two screaming kids at home. And I thought, do you know what? No. So I got retrained into marketing. And my friend was opening a business and tech law school in Bank in England, which is the city centre. And I turned it down a few times. She said, look, please, you're into events. You know exactly what customers want. You know the youth markets. We're full of young international students who are dying to learn about creativity and entrepreneurship and business. Why don't we pay for all of your degree? We'll get you an MBA. You can be as top as you can get PhD level. You can then use your business mind to talk about money, law, and then plug in creativity and entertainment. And I was like, you know what? That's a good idea. So I did it. So 5.5 years I spent there. I come out with the best qualifications possible. I got a fellowship award as well for my work industry, which is quite rare. And I was young to get that. That's like kind of Gandalf level, like fellowship stuff. And then I went into the city. I run tech startups, publishing companies, because I could do both the creative now and then people management, which is law, money, processes, system structures, bits of aliens to me. I was playing pianos and was like, what's the spreadsheet? Why do I need one of those? Now I got both.
Yeah. Okay, so you were in the corporate space for a number of years, and now have you gone back more into the entertainment side with your agency?
I have definitely leaned more into the entertainment industry as these new kind of entertainment management companies have grown through the roots again. There's a lot more niche and boutique ones, which is great for someone like me to jump in and help run. I'm across quite a few projects at the moment, which is also really fun, but all in sport. I also I'm the CMO for the number one sport homeless charity in the UK, and they are just doing phenomenal. We've changed over 10,000 young people's lives in 5 years, and we are working with people like Prince Williams to end homelessness in the UK. But entertainment is a big thing, a part of it, because you know, sport is entertainment. Watching football is entertainment. Listening to music is entertainment. So I've just kind of tried to drill a middle ground to say everything I've ever done, from working with Five Star, performing nightclubs, on stage at concerts and Wembley, has all been about entertaining someone else. Like I've created something that other people enjoy. And that bit's never changed. And I've always been skewed to these youth markets. That kind of 12 to 24 bracket's always been a thing. I just seem to know, I probably know what they don't like straight away. And then I get to the crux of it. Well, I think you're going to like this. This would be really fun for you. So I've stayed in corporate. I stayed in creativity. I've joined the two together. It gets a lot harder when you get older because I can't normally say the word smash it to somebody, Barrett, and they go, what's that?
Yeah.
What? Is that a new TikTok shop? No, it's a magazine. Is that, what's a magazine? Like, oh, dear Lord. Forget it.
Exactly. I'm still old school. I still buy my books. I still buy my CDs. I still get my photos developed. You know, this thing of having everything on one space, it just, for me, just confuses my brain.
Yeah, totally. And books is the last art that's working well. So in UK, it's 6 billion pounds a year in book sales, physical book sales.
Oh,
Six
wow.
billion.
Okay, so that's.
It's the last of the arts that's doing well. And obviously, I'm now writing books and stuff as an author about the paranormal and ghosts and stuff, which is a big
Oh.
thing of mine that I've had since I was a child. I have management. I'm not published yet, but I'm with you. I love the book part. I think it's an amazing vehicle for children and adults.
Have you written one or more books?
There's a hexology, which is six books in six parts. The first two are done, and we've been working with publishing houses to secure a couple of deals. We have one in play. Obviously, I can't say too much on this call,
Yeah.
but yeah, it's moving in the right way. But with all good records, all good books, all good films, art, it needs to just take a step back and get some feedback and harness it to its absolutely perfect, and then we're off.
Is it a fictional book or non-fiction?
Yeah, it's fantasy. So if you
Okay.
like the program Stranger Things, which is on Netflix, it's
Yes.
very, very dark. It's all, again, youth orientated because it's the market I understand the most. So it's very cool, but it's all about the paranormal and ghosts in an underworld. And it's set in
Okay.
England in 1673. So very British, very monarchy. It's called Ghosts of the Monarchy. That's the actual title. So it's all about ghosts and royalty and Middle England. So
Yes.
hugely popular in the world for science and fantasy.
Okay, so when did you start writing it, and what was that thing within you that was like, ah, I've got this story, I want to start writing it?
So I actually had the original idea in about 2003 when I went to Los Angeles for the first time. And I used to get booked to do crazy parties for like celebrities like Hugh Jackman, the X-Men. Some of the guys that we knew were the original directors of Lord of the Rings and X-Men and Superman and Spider-Man. And I was honest. I said, I've got this great idea. What do you think about it? And Brian, who was one of the lead directors in the world at that point, he's like, I really like it. He said, my advice is going to be weird to you, but leave it kind of 10 years. It's because you've got all of these Harry Potter movies. There's Lord of the Rings 2, 3 coming out. There's Spider-Man, X-Men, what's 6 franchise. You'll probably get swallowed up. Wait till they're kind of done, then come back to it. He said, and then call me and I'll put it at the top of the pile and I'll read it. And you know what? I did that and he did it and he goes, it's excellent. And the time is right. If there's nothing like the top 100 book charts or movie charts like this, you should
Yes.
go for it. So we are. That's it.
I know you had the idea, but was it difficult to concretize that idea and formulate it into a story for six books, or did it just flow naturally?
It just naturally had it, actually, and a bit like creating a song as I did 30 years ago. I had the master idea. I
Yes.
knew how it would kind of visualize on screen or in my music head. I could hear it on Capital FM, for example. Like, what does that sound like? How long is it? What's the speed? What's the tone? And I knew all the components. So I've just literally picked up my music brain and gone plonk into a book brain. But that piece has been the most easy part. So the big vision was easy. The harder bit was writing 111,000 words as a novel, which is an exceptionally long book, but it needs to be super long to make a 3-hour movie because that's where we're going with it.
Oh, this is very exciting. I love fantasy books. I'm sure you're aware of Cassandra Clare, and she's got all those Mortal Instruments series and the different offshoots. So I've read all of those books like 20 times. So I'm really looking forward to this batch of books or this series. I can't wait. Are you still doing any music production, or is that completely out of your wheelhouse?
It's out of my wheelhouse at the moment. I advise on it and I help develop youth talent. There is an opportunity to go back in it probably circa Christmas next year with something in the US, but and I'd love to go back to it. I have missed it. I've missed playing the piano, I've missed songwriting, but it never leaves you. It never leaves you. And switching it back on is the easiest ask in the world. So I'm not currently dabbling. I am working on a project that is very focused around that. And, I obviously with leaving the music industry, you carry on with people like your Judge Jules and your Pete Tongs. They grow with you. And it's
Yes.
amazing how much you still connect at some point down the line. They go, hey, we've got this project in Ibiza. You should come and do this. And I'm like, oh, okay, great. But yeah, so fingers crossed, watch this space.
So focusing specifically on songwriting now that you referenced, let's unpack that. What invigorates it? What motivates it? Is it easy every time? Let's unpack your creative brain with regards to songwriting.
Sure. It's not easy every time. And I've done a whole kind of seminar on this before. And the key to every hit song really is lullaby. So the words are great. and they are meaningful, but Elton John never wrote the music. He just wrote the words, and he was brilliant at it. But Bernie Taupin had the musicality. And if you think about every ABBA record that was ever ABBA's hits, they're all what I would call lullaby. And what I call lullabies, you know, as a child, you get taught Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, right? And it's those kind of themes in records that always are the big hits. From One Direction to the Beatles to Mariah Carey, it's those simple, very catchy pop riffs. And if you don't get the lullaby, there is no record. It's just what we call B-sides. They're a hobby. And I teach this is that you either have a career as a music writer, songwriter, or you have a hobby. Because if you can think what Capital FM or Radio 1 or Kiss want to play, then you're in the right ballpark, because they're only going to sign works of art, publishing music that are going to appeal to radio and their audiences and their concerts and their festivals globally. So you've got to get on that page quickly, because else writing a song for you is a hobby. Writing a song for a million people, which I did, was a career. And the difference is outstanding. And to see it, and I've seen a million people go nuts to my record, and it is a feeling you can never replicate again. It's the most rewarding thing in the world.
You mentioned earlier that it's easy for you to tap into the younger generations, the age 12 to 24 age group. Why do you think that is? What do you see in them that allows you to spark ideas, spark creativity, and spark the knowing, oh, they will enjoy this?
Yeah, I think I've always just been in tune with what younger people want. Obviously, the idea of, like, currently in England, we've got some challenges, haven't we? Let's face it, as a political nation. And young people see through that very quickly. You know, they are the number one ad blockers in the world for mobile phones. So they basically, on their phones, they turn off all adverts. They're not interested in that. So they want stories, storytelling. And the bit I've always done is that. So when I see a billboard poster, or I start to watch a film, or watch a trailer, it's interesting. So I used to work at Unilad, was their first entertainment and business development director. So obviously they're the most famous millennial platform in the world now, called Lad Bible. And you'd see a 30-second trailer from Universal Music around, let's say, a new movie called The Moon, for example. And then the first 2 seconds was a very beautiful shot of, like, the moon. It was kind of twisting, and you'd kind of steer over it. But unfortunately, the run rate was 1.2 seconds. So I'm like, you've just paid $1 million for your advert or feature film. That segment, they've got, oh, I've seen a picture of a moon, don't know, off, and they're gone. And Warner Brothers were the first to kind of wake up to this and go, holy rubbish. I was like, what should we do? I was like, well, open with the date, 01/01/16, for example, 1st of January. That's when the movie, so even if I don't like the movie, you've really taught me when it's going live, because my friend might like Harry Potter 6 or Harry Potter 7, and now I know, and I'm into it. So having the instinct understanding of quickness but quality is really important to young people. They are an instant gratification age. I think they always have done. When I created Winston the Churchill Bulldog about 31 years ago, the brief was simple. They had no female customers buying insurance. It was like, well, put a puppy in front of it, because if you put a puppy dog, the world's going to go, oh, it's really cute. And then they need to buy car insurance. They go, I want the puppy one. Where's the puppy one? And it worked, and it's still there. 31 years on, it's still the face of a financial services business. And it was my idea, and it was a puppy dog. And that was simply it. So whenever I see it, from Ribenas to Diet Coke, I look at the advert and go, does it matter? Who cares? Does it excite me? Does it tick the box? So it's just an inherent understanding. And all of my career since music has been, this guy just can look at something and go, that's got to be different. But unlike the record company execs, I'll go in with a load of recommendations, like, you should try this, blah, 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 blah. Because I've been the person that had to pick up all of the emotions and all of the rubbish and deal with it. So that's really where my head comes from. It's creativity first and purpose second. Purpose has become a lot more in advertising, films and music than ever before. And I think it's got better as we've grown older as a race, but it always existed. Even back in the 90s, it was a big thing, purpose. People did want to be a part of a story that was good and not bad.
Okay, so I've got a point of discussion around this. So I saw an article, or a couple of articles, and one specifically around last year, end of last year, where certain radio stations perceive that a female, they don't mention male, but female artists over the age of 30 are no longer relevant. They no longer have value towards the listening audience, and therefore they will not play any songs by artists over the age of 30. And this has been consistent over time. Obviously, with streaming, it's broken these barriers or walls a bit. I remember I was reading Bananarama's autobiography, and I remember that they were dropped by their record label at the age of 24, 25, because the label perceived them as no longer of value or relevance, because now they were of this age, which is seen to be no longer relevant. And this was in the 80s. It's still happening these days, but now with the advent of social media, it's breaking things away or breaking things down. A good example is Kylie Minogue's Padam Padam. I remember last year, the radio stations didn't want to play it because she was seen as being too old at the age of 55. But then it blew up and went viral on social media. So they were then forced to play it because it was being so popular. What are your thoughts around this? So we have these stories that keep coming through, but then also we have these gatekeepers that are blocking it for the simple fact that, oh, in inverted commas, speaking as them, we don't think it will be played or enjoyed or seen or heard because it's in a box that we are putting it in and stereotyping it in. And therefore, because of this box, we don't feel it's relevant. What are your thoughts around this?
Yeah, I think this is one of the positives around social media, and there's not too many of them at the moment, but this is a big one, is that if you're, and I'm going to be brutal about this, if you're a crusty old executive sitting in your boardroom in your big leather chair with your Scotch whiskey in your hand or wherever it is, deciding on a P&L or a law, that is never going to translate anymore. And ageism and sexism, racism have never really had a place in society ever, ever, ever. And it's getting better at social media. For example, like women in film, the Black Lives Matter movement has just been brilliant around how we change stereotypes and gender equality and stuff. And what's lovely is businesses get hurt in the pocket. Now, that's a strange thing to say. Why is that lovely? It's because the shareholders will go, the general public don't think this is good. They're not going to buy our butters or our milks or our meats or our vegan products if we keep making stupid decisions around women pay gaps or not being friendly around LGBTQ+, which is a big part of my life. So what should we be doing? So social media and consumers, particularly young people, very good at this, which is why I love them. They're very good at forcing change with a digital agenda, which then ends up on the spreadsheet right at the back. And then someone probably phones at me or someone like me and goes, we're in a bit of a crisis. Not quite sure we got here, but I'll tell you what you did is you didn't look after the plus 50 females that are singing songs still. So that's so new. So why don't you suck it up and and do something different about it?
Yeah.
So, and there's a lot of things around social impact now, like homelessness and, for example, firms are measuring ESG. S is the social impact piece, which is huge in England and across the world. And that word sustainability is going to be with us for the rest of our lives, thank God, because we do need to do something very different.
Yeah.
So in short, the world is talking, but don't be that brand that isn't listening, because if you don't listen, you are bust. And within a year, you can be flipped out of the FTSE or Wall Street, and you're fired and your company's dead. With 2,000 employees, it's not just you anymore. You've got a big infrastructure. So hopefully that answers your question.
Yes, absolutely. You've totally given me food for thought. So thank you for that. I love this game. I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 8 years, I know your answer will be different every time, because there are millions of them. I recognize that and I understand that. I'm not saying favorite, I'm saying top of mind. But if you had to push play to 5 songs by other artists once we finish this conversation, what would those 5 songs be and by whom?
Oh, good question. So I'm going to go for Upbeat Records. I love soul records, but I'm going to say Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody, because if you're ever in a bad mood, it would be the song that picks you up. I then say 5-Star Rain or Shine, because I just absolutely love that record. It was their biggest hit. Such a good record. Probably Aha, Take On Me, because it's another epic song. Stevie Wonder, I'm stuck with what one to choose, but I'll probably go Bad Mama Jamma. It was amazing. And then I'll probably go Janet Jackson, Miss You Much.
So the podcast is listened to throughout the world. So as a final message, what would you like to say?
I'd like to say, be kind to each other, be brave. And at 18, if I could have given myself some advice, and to everybody listening to this, is listen to yourself, do some decent market research, because we have those tools now, because you're probably right with your gut feeling, and have less than five people in your hand that count the most in your life. You don't need 20. You definitely don't need 30. And keep yourself distant on social media for your children and your family's lives. And make sure your mental health is first every time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.